This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. ولئن أذقنا الإنسان منا رحمة ثم نزعناها منه ولئن أذقناه نعماء بعد ضراء مسته ليقولن ذهب السيئات عني إنه لفرح فخور إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير. صدق الله العلي.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favor after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely, he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good. They shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran says it respects the territorial integrity of all countries and that diplomacy is the best way to settle differences with neighboring Azerbaijan. Poland places its military on alert after a missile hits its territory near the border with Ukraine. And Donald Trump officially launches his presidential campaign with a promise to make sure Biden doesn't get into office for 4 more years. Many thanks for joining us. Iran says the diplomatic channel is the best way to resolve misunderstandings with Azerbaijan. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the remark during a phone conversation with his Azeri counterpart Ceyhun Bayramov. He was referring to recent comments by Azerbaijan's president about Azeri-speaking Iranians. Amir Abdollahian expressed discontent with President Ilham Aliyev's comments. The Iranian diplomat said respecting the sovereignty and territorial integrity of other countries must be a basic principle for any nation. For his part, Bayramov described as positive talks and contacts between Iranian and Azeri officials. He said Baku is ready to boost relations with Tehran in an effort to settle differences. Iran's envoy to the UN says Israel is the main obstacle to a Middle East free of weapons of mass destruction, calling on the international community to assist the region in overcoming such an obstacle. Amir Saidi Ravani underlined that the Israeli regime is equipped with all types of these inhumane weapons. He lamented that Western states remain silent on Israel developing WMDs with the U.S. support. He was addressing a U.N. conference on the establishment of a Middle East zone free of nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction. Israel is estimated to have 200 to 400 nuclear warheads in its arsenal. The regime has refused to either join the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty nor allow inspections of its nuclear military facilities. The 9th Joint Economic Commission of Iran-Venezuela has wrapped up after 3 days in Tehran. Officials from both countries signed MOUs that paved the way for stronger business relations between Tehran and Caracas. Gisu Misha Ahmadi has more from Tehran.
3 days of intense negotiations at the 9th Economic Commission has led to several agreements that can be considered a turning point in Iran-Venezuela relations. As a result, cooperation will expand in the fields of industry, mining, energy, trade, agriculture, and science and technology.
During the 9th Joint Economic Commission, we discussed ways to implement the previous agreements and facilitate trade between the two countries. One particular area of interest is agriculture, given Venezuela's great potential with over 30 million hectares of arable land.
Más alegría en saber.
Venezuelan agricultural products will be exported to Iran, while the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela will allocate some 500,000 hectares of agricultural land to the Islamic Republic for the public and private sector to make investments in this field.
Iran has also agreed to export more than 100,000 cars to Venezuela in a period of 5 years and to share the technology of its knowledge-based products.
We have already established air routes, but maritime transport can play a crucial role, allowing trade between the two countries to grow even stronger.
The Joint Commission has taken major steps in expanding bilateral ties based on the 20-year cooperation roadmap signed during the visit by President Nicolas Maduro to Tehran in June 2022. The 10th Joint Commission has been scheduled to take place in 6 months in Venezuela, where both sides will analyze the results of the session.
The cooperation agreement signed at the end of the three-day economic commission will allow the expansion of bilateral ties between Iran and Venezuela to a new level.
Poland raises its military readiness after a projectile landing in one of its eastern villages kills two people near the border with Ukraine. Polish government says the explosion was most probably caused by a Russian-made missile. It has summoned Russia's ambassador to Warsaw for an explanation. Meantime, U.S. President Joe Biden and some of his allies who are in Bali, Indonesia for the G20 summit have held emergency talks over the matter. Biden has said that a missile is unlikely to have been fired by Russia itself, but that more investigations need to be carried out. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has also expressed concern about the situation, saying it's absolutely essential to avoid an escalation in the war. The Ukrainian president, though, has been less cautious at pointing fingers. Vladimir Zelensky says the explosion has been an attempt by Moscow to spread terror.
Firing missiles at NATO territory is a Russian attack on collective security. This is a very significant escalation. We must act. I want to say now to all our Polish brothers and sisters, free people will not be broken by terror.
Other European countries have also rejected the missile strike in Poland. London has expressed solidarity with Warsaw, saying it will offer any assistance to find out where the missile originated. France has urged NATO countries to approach the matter with utmost caution. A French presidency official said many countries in Europe possess the same kind of weapon, so it's not easy to identify who was behind the attack. Moscow, on the other hand, has denied involvement, saying it fired no missiles near Poland's border. The Russian defense minister has described the reports as a deliberate provocation aimed at escalating the situation. Nearly 10 months into the Russia-Ukraine war, Moscow accuses Kiev of failing to find any peaceful solution to end the deadly conflict.
Third world countries are calling for a peaceful settlement, call for agreements to be made quickly. They know perfectly well that Ukraine is dragging out this process, that the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky banned at a legislative level, banned holding negotiations with Russia by his order. So it's not a question for us. And that is what I said today to French President Emmanuel Macron and German Chancellor Olaf Scholz during brief talks.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Ukraine is refusing to talk to Russia and has put forward what he called unrealistic conditions for peace. The top Russian diplomat also slammed the West for its approach toward the Russian offensive in Ukraine, accusing the United States and its allies of provoking the conflict. Lavrov said the West started the Ukraine war and had been preparing for it for many years. The Russian military offensive in Ukraine began on February 24th. Russia has fired a barrage of missiles on several Ukrainian cities, causing widespread power outages and shutdowns. Ukrainian officials say more than 7 million homes are now cut off from electricity after 15 energy facilities were damaged across the country. The power outages have been reported in the cities of Lviv and Kharkiv. Sumy region in the east as well as Orivna in the west are targeted too. Ukrainian forces say Russia has fired around 100 missiles on the country. Joining us from Donetsk is Johnny Miller, who will give us an update on the situation in Ukraine and the recent missile which had been found in the Ukrainian-Polish border. Johnny, over to you.
Yes, Russia launched, which may have been its largest missile barrage on Ukraine, targeting energy infrastructure yesterday, and we have these missiles landing in Poland at a Polish farm, killing two people. Now, there was some initial chatter that this strike could trigger Article 5. Of course, Article 5, meaning that if one NATO country is attacked, that the whole bloc is attacked. Initial fears that this could well mark the beginning of World War III, but that chatter quickly died down. So what happened? There's propaganda battle going on at the moment, some suggesting that it was a Russian missile, also evidence suggesting that it was a Ukrainian anti-air defense missile that hit the farm. But at the moment, an investigation is going on. Some in the Western media are suggesting that this may well have been a Russian attempt to test NATO's resolve. I do find that unlikely. There's also other suggestions that this was a provocation from Ukraine. Of course, Ukraine very keen for NATO to get more involved in the conflict. All this could well have just been an accident. Accidents happen in war. But this does raise the very real possibility that the beginning of World War III or nuclear Armageddon could well begin due to an accident or a miscalculation from both sides. It's also clear that events like this have been used by both sides to escalate the conflict. So we'll find out whether in the coming days that whether NATO will use this event to get even more involved in the conflict than they already are.
Definitely would be very interesting to see how things will unfold. Johnny, Russia has been rejecting the claims that it was Russia's missile that detonated in a Polish border with Ukraine. Whoever that was behind this missile attack can be said that was looking for a provocation of this, for an escalation of the situation between Russia and Ukraine. Do you think an escalation can be on the cards? How do you assess the situation right now?
Well, yes, as I said, an investigation is ongoing. Whether any results in that investigation will be honestly given to the public around the world is another question. Events like this tend to set off propaganda battles between the two sides. And as I said, yeah, there has been some suggestion of, that this may have been a provocation by Ukraine or may well have just been an accident. But Ukrainian officials are already saying, well, NATO needs to be more involved because of this event. Of course, if Article 5 is triggered or if NATO gets even more involved in this war, it could well mean a clash between Russia and NATO, which would have huge ramifications on the world. But I think in one way or another, this event will be used for some kind of political opportunity by NATO, whether that's increasing support, whether that's increasing its demonization of Russia. But there's no doubt this event will be used in some way or another.
Johnny, thank you so much for joining us out of Donetsk this morning. Thank you. Former U.S. President Donald Trump is once again back in the race for the White House in the 2024 elections.
In order to make America great and glorious again, I am tonight announcing my candidacy for President of the United States.
During his speech, Donald Trump also vowed to prevent President Joe Biden from becoming president for a second term. Trump's paperwork establishing his candidacy was delivered to the Federal Election Committee shortly before he made the announcement. In the midterm elections last week, the Republicans failed to obtain the anticipated red wave of victories. They failed to win the Senate, but are still on track to win control of the House. Biden, who's currently in Bali for the summit of G20 leaders, reacted to the news by saying Trump has failed America. Trump is entering the race for presidency while he's facing trouble on several fronts, such as the attack on the Capitol building by his supporters in 2021, as well as the removal of classified documents from the White House. He has called the investigations politically motivated and denies wrongdoing. U.S. President Joe Biden and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping have held their first face-to-face meeting on the sidelines of the G20 summit in Indonesia's Bali. It was an attempt to reduce tensions recently fueled by the U.S.'s ties with Taiwan, which China sees as interference in its internal affairs. In the meeting, both leaders highlighted the need to manage differences and avoid conflicts.
United States should take history as a mirror and let it guide the future. That's what the Chinese President Xi Jinping told his American counterpart Joe Biden on the sidelines of the Group of 20 summit in Bali, Indonesia.
As always, I'm ready to have a candid and in-depth exchange of views with Mr. President on issues of strategic importance in China-US relations and major global and regional issues at our meeting today. I also look forward to working with you to bring China-US relations back to the track of healthy and stable development.
We share responsibility, in my view, to show that China and the United States can manage our differences, prevent competition from becoming anything ever near conflict, and to find ways to work together on urgent global issues that require our mutual cooperation.
The two held their first ever in-person meeting as relations between Washington and Beijing are at their lowest in decades, marred by disagreements over a host of issues from Taiwan to trade. During the landmark three-hour meeting, the Chinese president warned his U.S. counterpart not to cross Beijing's red line over Taiwan. According to the Chinese state media, Xi stressed that Taiwan is the bedrock of the political foundation of bilateral relations. Biden, for his part, said the U.S. wants to manage differences with China to prevent competition from becoming conflict. Biden said he sought to assure Xi that U.S. policy on Taiwan has not changed, seeking to lower tensions over the self-ruled island.
And I do not think there's any imminent attempt on the part of China to invade Taiwan. And I made it clear that our policy on Taiwan has not changed at all. It's the same exact position we've had. I made it clear that we want to see cross-strait issues peacefully resolved.
On North Korea, Biden told Xi that Beijing has an obligation to attempt to talk Pyongyang out of conducting a seventh nuclear test.
The meeting between Biden and Xi follows a spike in tensions between Washington and Beijing after a flurry of visits by U.S. officials and lawmakers, including House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, to Taiwan. The trips have sparked angry reactions from Beijing and even prompted unprecedented Chinese military drills around the self-ruled island, which China claims as part of its territory.
China relations have been strained in recent years by growing tensions over issues ranging from Taiwan to the South China Sea, trade practices, and U.S. restrictions on Chinese technology. Regarding Taiwan, Beijing says it's a matter for the Chinese and China's internal affair. Anyone that seeks to split Taiwan from China will be violating the fundamental interests of the Chinese nation. Tensions over the self-ruled island have intensified following a provocative visit there in August by the U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi. The move prompted large-scale Chinese military drills around the island territory, as well as a declaration by the U.S. President Joe Biden to defend Taiwan. Beijing has time and again slammed U.S. provocations, including encouraging and supporting pro-separatist independence forces on the island, saying that Washington has no right to interfere in how to resolve the Taiwan issue. Also, Biden dropped the hammer on China's semiconductor industry by fully implementing a slew of tough controls on the export of American chip technology to China. It would also undermine China's ability to import, manufacture, and export the semiconductors that run the world. The goal was to slow down and prevent Chinese military and technological advances. Washington also takes sides with Beijing's rivals in a maritime dispute in the South China Sea, by routinely sending warships and warplanes to the waters to assert what it calls its right to freedom of navigation. China has repeatedly called on Washington to stop the provocative actions, which undermine peace and stability in the strategic waters. Last month, the White House and the Pentagon declared Beijing as Washington's most serious strategic competitor, and reports outlining U.S. defense and foreign policy strategies. Therefore, despite Biden's meeting with Xi, can the two manage their differences to prevent conflict? Or is it inevitable that the two are on the collision course?
Well, those were the top stories for this hour. Many thanks for joining us.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day He appointed for a rising. To Thee belongs praise, for Thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst Thou willed, Thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to Thee belongs praise, for Thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to Thee, to be joyful in worshipping Thee, to be desirous of Thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me Thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom Thou wilt.
In the limelight.
News headlines on Europe's energy crisis may shock everyone, but the reality is much worse as winter is coming and European households are dealing with high energy costs. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned, please. Global Times wrote, European countries are preparing to face a severe and tough winter as the energy crisis further escalates amid the worsening Russia-Ukraine crisis and the explosions of the Nord Stream pipelines, while the U.S. is trying to use high energy prices to further weaken Europe's economy and force manufacturing industries to escape from the continent, said experts. They noted that EU leaders need to consider carefully of the future of EU-US relations. The analysts also said the EU can only ensure a sustainable peace and development of the continent when it keeps solidarity and independent policymaking. Chinese analysts recently said that some EU countries, especially major EU economies, purchasing energy from the US with extreme high price is a situation forced by the geopolitical crisis rather than normal business deal following market law, so it won't be sustainable, and in the future, EU nations are paying efforts to diversify their energy dependency to other countries, rather than binding too tightly with the US. French President Emmanuel Macron said recently that European nations should join Asian economies to demand that the US and Norway show greater friendship by selling gas at lower prices. Addressing a conference of entrepreneurs in Paris, Macron said countries sanctioning Russia are united as freedom fighters but divided as producers or consumers of the fossil fuel. France intends to raise the issue with the G7 in particular, he said. The gas market doesn't really exist at the moment, the French president said, adding that leading economies should try to return it to a price corridor that makes sense. Wang Yiwei, director of the Institute of International Affairs at the Renmin University of China, told the Global Times recently that the high energy prices will surely divide the West because it's very clear that U.S. energy companies are using the crisis to get rich, and the high prices will directly hit the EU economy by increasing the cost for the manufacturing industries. In the future, with the worsening of Ukraine crisis, more and more manufacturing industries will flee Europe and move to Asia and America, and then the Europe's economy will be hollowed out. Now, due to the governmental subsidies, the ordinary people's daily lives don't see major change. But in the long term, the high debts and the weakening national strength will eventually impact the people's livelihoods in the continent, Wang noted. There is nothing much that the EU can do to stop the crisis at the moment. Even EU elites clearly understand US strategy of using the Russia-Ukraine crisis to weaken its major economic competitor, the EU said, analyst. The internal divergences make the EU unable to jointly handle the crisis as a strong and solid power, they noted. The energy crisis is now impacting more and more major EU economies. Central heating will be restricted in Italy this winter as it becomes the latest country to take action on European gas supply shortages sparked by the Ukraine crisis. Under a new government decree, buildings in Italy will face an extra 15 days without central heating, according to media reports. The proposals include a cap on gas prices backed by the majority of EU countries, but opposed by Denmark, Germany, and the Netherlands, which worry it would make it difficult to buy the gas their economies need and curb any incentive to reduce consumption, Reuters reported recently. Spain's energy minister, Teresa Ribera, told Reuters in an interview that the opponents of a gas cap needed to accept that Europe faces a disaster. While selling energy to Europe at a high price, the U.S. is also further hyping the danger of nuclear war in Ukraine that could bring doomsday destruction to Europe, and France has expressed its concern recently. The U.S. is not making efforts to ease the tension, but it uses the tension to spread fear and concerns over Europe. The U.S. wants to make Europe to look like a continent with great uncertainty and tough economic environment, and then the Europeans with talents and the capitals will emigrate to the U.S. to help Washington in handling its own economic mess. Choi Ho-jian, director of the Department of European Studies at the China Institute of International Studies, told the Global Times recently that the EU has already paid the prices for the crisis because in front of the severe geopolitical problem, it has no capability to solve the problem independently, and it has to rely on the US, so the EU might see the economic losses as the prices that it must pay. Choi noted, but the EU wants the prices as limited as possible. EU leading members don't trust other countries, and they also don't trust the US, especially after Donald Trump's term. The EU has noticed that US will handle transatlantic relations on a realistic basis, and the US hegemony is declining, so Washington is getting less and less reliable. This is why the EU is seeking more diversified energy supplies from Africa and the Middle East. Meanwhile, RT reported turning away from Russian energy will lead to very deplorable consequences for the European Union, with up to 20 years of deindustrialization ahead, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov has said. In an interview with the TV channel Russia One, fragments of which were released recently, Peskov said the Americans are now making crazy money by selling gas to European states at exorbitant prices. He said, and Europeans pay them, thereby depriving their economy of competitiveness. Production is collapsing, deindustrialization is coming, and this will have very, very deplorable consequences for the European continent over probably at least the next 10 to 20 years. He emphasized that in the past there was a mutual balance, as Russia was interested in buyers of its energy resources as much as they were interested in Russia. However, Peskov argued the EU started to repeat like a mantra that it had to rid itself of its dependency on Russian energy, and this eventually resulted in the current situation. The Americans are selling gas at prices that are three or even four times higher than Russian gas, Peskov said, adding that the Europeans are making their economy less competitive as they pay such money to U.S. suppliers. Gas prices in Europe surged earlier this year in the wake of Russia-Ukraine crisis after the EU and Western countries outside the bloc imposed sweeping sanctions on Moscow and began a campaign of cutting themselves off from Russian energy supplies. Gas prices hit record highs, leading to a rise in overall inflation on the continent. Earlier this week, Belgian Prime Minister Alexandre de Croo warned that the continent might soon face a significant reduction in industrial activity and social unrest if nothing is done to lower energy prices. Reuters, meanwhile, reported that the U.S. is now delivering more natural gas to the EU than Russia for the first time in history, but that American gas was 10 times more expensive than Russian supplies.
IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In defense of forests.
The indigenous people of Suriname amount to 20,344 individuals, about 3.8% of the country's population. The four most populated indigenous towns of Suriname are Kalinia and Locono, known as the Lowland Communities, and Trio, Wayano, and some other Amazonians who live in the south and are known as the Highland People. During the time of the Dutch colony in the 17th century, the Native American local population of the area retreated back into the Amazon basin. 54,000 African slaves were sold in Paramaribo, the capital of Suriname, to work on sugarcane plantation in inhumane conditions, which caused many of them to flee into the forest. Suriname is one of the few countries in South America that has not yet ratified the Convention 169 of the International Labour Organization concerning the indigenous and tribal peoples. The country's legislation does not yet recognize indigenous communities, nor are there laws about their land ownership. Given the great profitability in natural resources exploitation and the biodiversity of the territory, this lack of a proper set of laws poses a direct threat to the existence of Native Americans of the region. 80% of Suriname is made up of primary tropical forests. The government has granted 40% of the lands to the fishing industry and the extraction and export of oil, bauxite, gold, and water.
If they're talking about development, it should benefit the group, you know, who lives in the interior. As I said, you can't talk about development if I'm not in the process. If I'm not a part, you know, of the process, if I'm not part of the management. I have to give you my own perspective, give you my experience, because it will affects and has impact on my life. So it's not that we are against, but we want to be a part and we want to share benefits of all those projects.
In the district of Guanica, the community of Pikimpoika is subject to a double threat. The advances of ecotourism, which led to the decision of constructing a highway through the village, and an agricultural project that involves deforestation. Thanks to the strong protests of the village chief, the highway construction has been stopped, but the agricultural project is still moving forward, and in the absence of a protective legislation for the indigenous people of Suriname, the local community is left without legal options to defend the territory. For For years, the state of Suriname granted property deeds to non-indigenous individuals as well as licenses to mining companies, permitting them to operate in the region without consulting with the indigenous community and without obtaining their consent. In the 60s, the American aluminum company Alcoa built a hydroelectric power plant on the Suriname River to supply power to its subsidiary, Suralco. In order to complete the project, Alcoa flooded 50,000 kilometers of forest, which included 43 villages of the Samaka community. As a result, 6,000 people were displaced and had to be relocated in migratory camps. Most of the indigenous people are deprived of electricity to this date.
It benefits only the multinationals because I think more than 80% of all this energy is going to the multinationals like Alcoa, Suralco, and now we have IAMGOLD. So I think it's not benefits the local people, nor the people who were displaced at that period.
Okay, my name is Guillermo Walker. I'm from Coffee Camp. About the history of Coffee Camp and yes. Coffee Camp was before in the lake they call from Bloemfontein to Mare. There was before, and they moved us because of the water. I don't know what it was, but they moved us from there and put us in Coffee Camp. Now the village name is New Coffee Camp because we are removed. It was like someone shoot you, you know. They won't give you life. I mean, it's not nice because our Maroon peoples have a tradition. When you live here, people of you die here. You want to stay there and live with your people until the end of time. You don't want to move and go and live somewhere else. Then it'd be like you lost your, your immune.
Your heritage?
Yeah. So, we want to live there with the people together and die with them together. That's it.
The increase in the price of gold makes Suriname a major exporter of this mineral, but extracting and processing gold leads to deforestation and the pollution of water. Therefore, the forests disappear and the natives are left without water. In small-scale or informal mining, mercury is used to process gold, and in large-scale mining, the companies use cyanide nitrate. The remains of this illegal substance stay in the water, polluting it for years.
Basically, you have two levels of mining. One is the large-scale mining done by incorporated companies, many of them multinationals. They tend to be more mechanized, have more advanced technology, better efficiencies, and use. It will often use a cyanide process.
Every year, 60 tons of mercury are discharged into Suriname's rivers because of informal mining. In the community of Apatina, blood tests were run and hair samples were taken to determine the level of mercury in the inhabitants' bodies. According to the results of the analysis, 109 members of Apatina tribe showed great contamination in blood due to the ingestion of mercury. Thank you. The state of Suriname exploited three natural reserves within the territories of Kalania and Locono, which belong to the indigenous people of the Lower Marowijne, the most important estuary in the region. In 2015, the Inter-American Court of Human Rights voted in favor of the Kalania and Locono people, demanding the state of Suriname to protect their rights by recognizing the collective legal personality of both communities as well as their collective property ownership rights.
I'd like to introduce myself. My name is Sarah Augustine. I'm the co-director of the Suriname Indigenous Health Fund. Our next point is on the health effects of mercury contamination associated with dumping mine waste. Mercury bioaccumulates in fish, which is the primary source of protein. We've demonstrated in the risk assessment that we've submitted to the commission, which was published in 2012. This research demonstrates the risk that is imposed on the community of Apatina as a result from having a contaminated food supply. We demonstrated neurological impact, including a surge in birth defects, sickness, disability, and premature death in our health assessment, which we've also submitted to the commission. That was rooted for peer review in 2013. We've noted that bacteria and E. coli is in the water from high concentrations of itinerant gold miners, those gold miners are operating with inadequate sanitation, so they're polluting the sole water supply for the Wayana people. This is particularly important for children under age 5 who are impacted by diarrhea and dehydration. The impact of mercury is also specifically harsh on the youngest and most vulnerable population. Women who are pregnant are most severely impacted by mercury intoxication, as well as children under 5, those people whose nervous systems are still developing. We have also demonstrated in our health assessments that all individuals of all ages, are actually impacted by mercury contamination from this waste, inadequate dumping of toxic waste. We understand from the testimony of our in-country partners that concession owners willingly and knowingly support small-scale gold mining. This is important to note because often in the news you will hear that these are illegal miners that come into Suriname lands and there's no way to control that. But actually we are told that those people who control concessions in the interior are benefiting from that gold mining and are in partnership with these itinerant miners who come in and do this alluvial gold mining. Would like to ask the commission to encourage the state to regulate the gold mining industry and prohibit mercury pollution.
Despite the court's ruling, land concessions in Suriname continue. Another example is the planned expansion of Johan Adolf Pengel International Airport. The project involves issuing a land title which covers the traditional territory of at least 2 indigenous tribes, the Witsanti and Hollands Camp. 2 of the Witsanti leaders were brutally arrested after they prevented airport workers from taking technical measures necessary for the expansion in their village. After the arrest, the villagers erupted in protest and the residents of the area blocked the road to the airport, which resulted in the release of the leaders. The subsequent dialogue with the government has not yet produced any solution. In a previous ruling on the Saramaka case in 2007, the Inter-American Court of Human Rights decided that the states are obliged not only to consult with the indigenous communities according to their customs and traditions, but also to obtain their free, prior, and informed consent with regards to development or investment projects that may affect their territory. It was also established that the governments must reasonably share the benefits of such projects with the Saramaka people. Due to the constant repetition of violations against the rights of native people of Suriname, The court also ruled similar measures to be taken for all the indigenous tribes of the country. It also ordered the state to repair the serious damages caused by the bauxite extraction carried out by the Alcoa and BHP Billiton subsidiaries.
There should be social studies, you know, what the effects and the impacts of those projects. Also, what will they gain out of those projects? If they're going to get benefits, and what is the benefits? Because not only promises, but they have to be sure that it will give them work, you know, it will give them school, it will give them good health care. So we want to be a part of all those activities that the government and other third parties are planning to do and to have in our territory, in our communities, that will affect and that will have impact on our lives.
Following the decision of the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, there is hope that Suriname would adopt its own legislation in defense of the territories and other rights of indigenous people, especially now when the interest in biodiverse territories and resources such as bauxite, gold, water, and forests is growing.
In the limelight. Widespread dissatisfaction of employees working for the British National Health Service, NHS, including a significant part of doctors and nurses who are going to resign in protest at the current situation, has put this complex more than ever in danger of bankruptcy. The British Medical Association, which has recently conducted studies on the healthcare system, has warned about the collapse of the NHS. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has more. Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer has admitted the National Health Service is on the brink of collapse, but warned the struggling service will also need to play its part in helping fix Britain's broken economy. Chancellor of the Exchequer Jeremy Hunt said there were massive pressures in the NHS, with doctors, nurses on the front line, frankly, under unbearable pressure. However, Jeremy Hunt claimed the service received a lot of money and we need to do everything we can to find efficiencies. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak vowed to prioritise the National Health Service in his first speech as Prime Minister, but the Times reported that the Health Secretary, Steve Barclay, did not want to ask for money for the service in the autumn statement. Sources close to Steve Barclay have denied this, but did not reject claims he wanted to find cuts. The General Secretary of the Unison Trade Union, Christina McKenna, has accused the Tories of deliberately running down the NHS in an effort to allow an organisation to take over running it. Christina McKenna said, "Difficult things will happen if they do not make the right choices, and one of those is that the National Health Service is almost ready to collapse." She added, Excuse me for sounding like a conspiracy theorist, but I have heard so many people say it now. Is this partly a deliberate attempt by the government to run down the National Health Service in order to bring in some kind of organization to run it? I hope that's not what they're doing. What they aren't doing is making the right choices of investing in our public services. It comes as nurses plan to strike for the first time, taking action before Christmas. New figures show 7.1 million people in England were waiting for hospital treatment at the end of September, the highest since records began in August of 2007. When asked about nurses' pay demands, Jeremy Hunt said, "I think we have to recognize a difficult truth, that if we gave everyone inflation-proof pay rises, inflation would stay. We wouldn't bring down inflation, and that's why I'm not pretending there aren't some difficult decisions." The Shadow Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, said pay review bodies should work with unions to determine fair but affordable pay rises for nurses. The British newspaper The Daily Mirror has more on the same story. Britain's Chancellor Jeremy Hunt on Sunday, 13th of November, warned we're all going to be paying a bit more tax as he unveils his autumn statement budget. Reports suggest Jeremy Hunt will cut the £150,000 threshold for 45 pence tax to £125,000 to generate £1.3 billion a year, and cut energy bill support from £60 billion in the current 6 months to just £20 billion in the 6 months afterwards. But healthcare leaders have demanded extra funds for the National Health Service amid record waiting times. Jeremy Hunt told Sky News presenter Sophie Ridge that, frankly, this doesn't look like a health service that can find efficiency savings. This looks like a health service that is on the brink of collapse. The top Tory, a former health secretary and former chairman of the Commons Health Select Committee, replied, "There are massive pressures in the NHS." He said, "Obviously, it's something I know very well from previous jobs I've done, and I think that doctors, nurses on the front line are frankly under unbearable pressure. So I do recognise the picture that you say." NHS England figures showed a record 43,792 people waited longer than 12 hours in October, from a decision to admit to actually being admitted to a ward. These trolley waits were up a staggering 34% from 32,776 in September, the highest since records began in 2010. Shadow Chancellor Rachel Reeves said public services are already on their knees. 7 million people are waiting for a National Health Service operation or support. It came as Chancellor Jeremy Hunt admitted he will be a Scrooge in this autumn statement on Thursday with no rabbits out of the hat. He refused to deny it would mark a return to austerity, replying, "There will be difficult decisions and we will be asking everyone for sacrifices." Jeremy Hunt warned he won't be offering motherhood and apple pie, or cakeism, an accusation he laid at Boris Johnson's door. The Chancellor is eyeing up £33 billion a year of spending cuts and £21 billion a year of tax rises by 2027, in a bid to balance the books. Echoing George Osborne's austerity rhetoric, he tried to claim the nation's finances were like a family budget, despite the £2.4 trillion national debt. Jeremy Hunt told the BBC, "We're going to see everyone paying more tax. We're going to see spending cuts." Sky News has also covered the same story. The Shadow Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rachel Reeves, has said it's a badge of shame that nurses are staging their first ever nationwide strike in England, but also refused to commit to a 17% pay rise. Rachel Reeves said, "I'm not going to pluck numbers out of the air, and it's up to the pay review bodies to work with the unions, despite the fact that the pay review bodies have already reported back, and it's up to the government." Rachel Reeves added, "I don't believe that austerity 2.0, after the austerity that we've gone through for the last 12 years, is the right approach." She said she would close tax loops on big global multinationals to bring in an extra £7 billion a year. She also repeated the Labour Party's pledge to levy a 45% capital gains tax on private equity fund managers instead of the current 28%. British nurses have voted for the first time to go on industrial action before Christmas, as increase in the inflation rate has plunged many Britons into dire economic straits.